Wall Street, for better or worse, looks for where the money is being made. And once they started to really look into the growth percent, numbers in the plant-based meat aisle, the success of the IPO, everybody started looking for the next one.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. Today's conversation is with Michael Pellman Rowland. Michael is a financial advisor whose specialty is around sustainability and impact. He's also been writing about the subject for years, primarily for Forbes. He writes about the future of food, sustainable food startups and technologies. Really, he writes about all the goings-on in the plant-based food world. Hey, Michael, thank you so much for coming today, or not coming, being here in quarantine. How are you?
I'm good. I'm there in spirit.
I feel it. Good vibes are coming through. How's the quarantine situation for you?
I'm one of the lucky ones that has experienced this quarantine more as a sabbatical than as a severe either health or economic event. So fortunate enough to be able to work from home. Normally on the road quite a bit, so happy to have a reprieve from the normal, flights and trains and things that take me all over the world. I've used the time as effectively as I can, given the circumstances.
Which is great. And so, because even I don't fully really understand what you do, because I'm not a finance person, and I know a lot of people that listen aren't either. So can we start with just you explaining what it is that you do?
Sure. So I wear a few hats. The main one in the most basic terms is as a financial advisor. So all that really means is I advise some families, some individuals, some foundations on basically how to invest and give their money. And my specialty is around sustainability and impact. So all of the families and companies and organizations I work with specifically come to me to be able to invest and give their money more in alignment with their values or their worldview. And so that's things like the environment, things like gender inequality, things like animals. So my job is to go out and find the companies or the funds that invest in those companies that can make people as much money as they ever hope to make, but do so in alignment with the environmental and animal goals that they have.
How did this become your thing? Like, how did this all start?
Well, so I was in wealth management since day one. I was like 3 weeks out of college. I got hired by Morgan Stanley. And so I was initially working with the LGBT community. I had grown up in the West Village of New York. All my neighbors were gay, for lack of a better description. And I wanted to serve that community when I came out of college. And this was pre-marriage equality. So it seemed like a great opportunity to give advice to couples who legally couldn't get married. And there were a lot of financial penalties around that. In the course of that work, I started hearing from some of those clients that they wanted to avoid investing in some, quote unquote, bad companies, who had bad policies either to their employees or the messaging they were putting out into the world around the LGBT community. And that was kind of the first light bulb that went off in my head around social responsible investing. And so thankfully, as the laws changed in the U.S. around marriage equality, that advice that I was giving was no longer necessary. And so it allowed me to start transitioning more into sort of broad-based social responsible investing, sustainable investing, and what's now more commonly referred to as impact investing. But it really kicked into a different gear when I met my wife. She was supremely passionate about the environment, about animals, and just about in generally trying to make the world a better place.
You have a really good story about when you met your wife, and I think you should share it.
Yeah, sure. So we were luckily connected through one of my best friends and oldest friends from college. We got set up on a blind date. And 3 weeks after we were set up on this blind date, we were engaged. Totally was out of the blue for both of us. Neither of us thought we would ever make something of a decision that significantly so quickly. But, sparks flew. And thankfully, we didn't sort of resist what we believed to be sitting in front of us. So got married super quick. And, fell in love and just, we're off to the races. And as quickly as everything was going forward in a positive light, boom, Hillary gets cancer. And before we know it, we're just ensconced in this, you know, nightmare of not knowing why she was sick, you know, months and months of not knowing what was wrong, then finally figuring out that she had this rare form of lymphoma, and then, you know, just all the things that, you know, sort of followed on after that. And as rough as that period of time was, there were two really good things that came out of it. A, you know, we got a lot closer as a couple. You know, we were stress tested right off the bat and came through it in flying colors. And secondly, it got both of us, and particularly me, a lot more interested in both health and food and all of the things that we thought may have had an influence on her getting sick in the first place, you know, being 32 years old. And that just kind of led me down the rabbit hole of food and food sustainability and how that could potentially weave into the work that I was already doing and the investment advice I was giving people. And the kind of light bulb just like really switched on. And I felt like I had found my life's mission, for lack of a better description, and have just been pursuing it ever since. And it's led me to where I am today.
It's an incredible story. And it's such a hopeful, amazing love story. So what were some of the things that you did then that were healthy and sustainable?
Well, we both transitioned our diets significantly. So when I had met Hillary, I was already, you know, off dairy and gluten and really trying to eat, you know, just a lot healthier. Hillary was predominantly vegetarian, you know, had been donating her allowance to PETA since she was a kid, and, you know, always had a very, you know, sort of a sweet spot for animals. But in light of everything that went down and just the information we started learning together, we both, you know, switched predominantly to a plant-based diet almost immediately. And not only saw significant health benefits from that, but really started to feel good about that alignment that comes along with that diet as you start to learn more and more about the food system and really how, you know, taxing it is on humans, on the planet, and also on, you know, the billions of animals that we consume every year.
So when Beyond Meat went public, from your side of things, do you think that was like the start of, is that going to keep happening with a lot of these other companies? Or like, tell us about like what's happening in the space right now.
Sure. So, I mean, no question the Beyond Meat IPO was a watershed event. So you cannot overstate enough how big of a deal that was, because before then you had a relatively small group of folks, including myself, kind of, you know, leading the parade, cheering as loudly as we could, and largely falling on deaf ears outside of, you know, small pockets here and there. When that happened, everybody on Wall Street started to take notice, not just because it went public, but it was the most successful IPO since, I think it was like 2001 or something like that. And so, you know, Wall Street, for better or worse, you know, looks for where the money is being made. And once they started to really look into the growth percent, you know, numbers in the plant-based meat aisle, the success of the IPO, you know, everybody started looking for the next one. So, to your question, you know, what can we expect going forward? I think there's definitely going to be some additional IPO stories. Impossible Foods is likely to be another example of a company that goes public, but you won't necessarily see a wave of new entrants coming into the public markets. And the reason is that IPOs are just rare. It's very rare for a company to, you know, start as a, you know, small little startup and then eventually become a public company. And the reason that is that oftentimes along the way they get acquired before they're even in a position to go public. And what that means is, you know, maybe it'll be a Nestle or a General Mills or some other food company that'll say, hey, XYZ plant-based cheese company, or, you know, plant-based chicken company, or whatever it might be, you're growing, you know, gangbusters. We love what you're doing. We think you'd be a great fit in our portfolio. We're going to acquire you. And oftentimes that's an amazing event for the team that has, you know, started the company and for the investors that are in it.
And so for the companies that get acquired and for all these big meat companies now that are all doing, or a lot of them are doing their own versions of plant-based meats, what's that been like? Is that successful? Are people as excited about it?
I would say that consumers are less excited about it, specifically because they're not as big of a brand story. So part of what makes Beyond and Impossible and some of the other well-known companies exciting is that they've got incredible brands and they've built those brands very intentionally. And they have celebrities backing them, you know, like athletes and Beyonce and it's Jay-Z and, you know, it's Coldplay. I mean, you know, incredible endorsements that give it a cool factor that takes these companies and their products in a whole different realm. When Nestle launches its products, you know, you don't have celebrities and influencers lining up behind them. And so the intention is much different. They're much more of a mass market strategy based on cost.
Right.
Because the trick right now for a lot of the more exciting brands like Beyond and Impossible and some of the others is that they're more expensive than conventional meat. And so there's a bit of a penalty at the moment to eat plant-based when you could go and get your factory farm meat for much less in price. And so for most consumers who are on a budget and don't have that luxury, they're almost forced into purchasing products that they may not want and certainly may not be good for them. And so what these larger companies are doing to try to take market share from the Beyonds of the world is to, through their scale, because they're, you know, these operations are massive and they're global, they can produce product that is substantially cheaper and sell it at a discount in hopes that cost-conscious consumers will buy their products even if they don't necessarily like them as much or think they're as tasty.
So a couple questions about like the Beyonds and the Impossibles. One is, the truth is they're a little healthier than meat, but they're not that healthy yet.
Right.
Right. Correct. And so what do you say to people who say, well, you know, I'm not really concerned about the other things. I'm concerned about my health. Why do I want these?
Yeah. So great question. And I think those companies, whether it's Beyond or Impossible or others, will be the first to tell you that they don't think of these products as healthy. They're just healthier. And, you know, like if you want a burger, you're doing it because you feel like eating a burger. You know, you just want to have something that is satiating, that is, you know, fulfilling. It just tastes delicious in the same way that we reach for an ice cream. So they shouldn't be, you know, a staple in your diet, whether it's a factory farm burger or a plant-based burger. It's just that if you're going to eat a burger, it's better to eat a Beyond burger, both for health purposes and also for the environment and for the animals.
And when you first got into all this, I mean, there were very few plant-based meat companies around, right? Like it was kind of slim pickings in terms of what was happening.
Certainly like the Tofurkies, right, you know, have been around forever. And there, you know, some Daya's and, you know, some of the plant milks, you know, have been around forever. But I would say that outside of Tofurky, there really wasn't a super strong brand, maybe Silk, which is the soy milk brand, that really captured the consumer. And I think the biggest difference now is not only is there an infinitely larger number of SKUs or products that are in the market, but the brands and the performance has been significantly elevated, where the people who are starting these companies like the Beyonds and Impossibles and so on are not aiming for vegans to eat their product. Like, you know, they're not aiming to exclude them either, but they're really going after the meat eater, quote unquote, that is looking to flex in their diet more often because they're aware of factory farming. They're aware of how animals are treated. They're aware of how taxing it is on the environment. And as a result, they're trying to weave plant-based products into their diet on a regular basis, but they don't want to eat a crappy vegan burger. They want it to taste good. And so that was, you know, sort of the magic sauce, if you will, that the Beyonds and others have figured out is we've got to make it taste excellent. We can't just rely on people doing this and kind of holding their nose because that's not going to solve the larger problem. And now we're in a whole different category where both, you know, passionate entrepreneurs and amazing technology that is available today is allowing us to do things that you just couldn't do before, which includes what's called cellular agriculture, which is the process by which you can take cells from an animal. So think about you take a biopsy when you want to go to your, you know, skin doctor and find out if you have a problem, you know, skin cancer. You can take the same biopsy from a cow, you know, like a small amount of their cells from their body. You can bring it to a lab and you can grow meat without the animal. And it sounds super, you know, Frankenburger, you know, Star Trek kind of stuff, but they're doing it. They're raising a lot of money. A proportion of these companies like Tyson and so on are investing in them. And there's a very solid chance that you're going to start hearing about these products coming into the market within the next couple of years.
The big thing with all the lab meats is scale right now, right? Like that's like the next step. How long does it take the process from like start to finish?
There are no factories that exist to make this yet. But think of it similar. This is the most common analogy to brewing yeast for beer. There will be similar vats that will allow us to effectively brew meat. And once that happens, it's going to be a significant advancement, both in allowing people to enjoy the same meat that they always have, but in removing a lot of the negative externalities that come along with it, which is the environmental side and the animal side. And so for a lot of people, this is really the holy grail of what could potentially transform our food system in a way of which way we went from like horses to cars for transportation. It's a very similar leap. And what's so exciting is that it seems almost inevitable that this is going to happen and likely happen within 10 years. And it's a very exciting, you know, development both for investors, for the planet, and also for animals.
And how many companies are doing this right now?
I would say it's in the dozens now. Okay. Globally, you know, and it's in happening in the US, it's happening in Israel, and then also in Asia, you're seeing some of this. There's a really exciting all-female team in Singapore that's growing shrimp right now, and will eventually start, you know, moving on to things like lobster and crab and other crustaceans, but they're focusing on shrimp initially because it's the, I think it's the most popular seafood product consumed globally, and surprisingly to many has a significant impact on the environment, particularly around how they're raised in mangroves.
That's incredibly cool. Like, I can't imagine that.
I know.
Because this is all going exciting. To happen like faster than we realize it. And
certainly in our lifetimes, there have been some good, you know, sort of surveys and other market research studies done by like the Good Food Institute and others to get a sense of whether people eat it. And by and large, people are very interested in this and will most likely try it. And so I think the reality is this is coming sooner than later. And it's just a question of how fast, and in all likelihood, from what I can tell, you're probably going to see it first in Asia because their regulatory environment is a lot more friendly towards this. And will probably come to the US or the Americas after that, and then probably Europe last. But there's still a lot that can happen between now and then.
So for now, it's plant-based, and the whole trajectory from where we were 5 years ago, even right to now, has been incredible.
Yeah, we're moving at, you know, we're moving at speeds that even the most optimistic animal lovers could have ever hoped.
So, and it's incredible how many, like with all of these companies who are really not really aiming their products at vegetarians or vegans, how well that has worked. It's amazing how many people I know who are not either, but yet love this stuff and are really excited by it, which is so cool to see, because it was not that long ago where those very same people were saying things like, you know, how crazy it was to not eat meat.
Yeah. The culture is definitely shifting. It's just a really great story to get on the bandwagon. I can't emphasize enough how important it is that you have sort of the celebrity and influencer engagement going on, where you have athletes and some of the most notable entertainers promoting these products, you know, talking about them at the Oscars, on Nike commercials, and, you know, everywhere in between, where that just wasn't the case before. I mean, I actually equate this similar to what happened with the LGBT community, where for a long time, you know, you just didn't, there, you know, companies couldn't, you know, participate in pride parades. It was a very, you know, sort of, you know, taboo kind of a thing. And then, you know, you basically had Ellen in your living room, and you had, you know, Doogie Howser, what's his name? I always forget his name.
Oh, Neil Patrick Harris.
You know who I'm talking about. And then it was just like, before you know it, you know, the people were in your living room and everybody loved them. And it was sort of like, hey, what am I being so weird about? And now, you know, supporting the LGBT community outside of certain circles in the world is celebrated and considered just morally and socially right. And that's why the prospects for this industry is so explosive, and why the most ardent capitalists are looking to get their money in, is because the growth of this industry is in its you know, infancy and is likely to become a significant piece of the overall food system.
I read your article on Starbucks now has Beyond Meat.
Right.
Has in it Canada, in right?
Canada. And since then, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, they just launched in Hong Kong as well.
Well, and then people who haven't tried it before, it's like that's how they get introduced. And it's a game changer.
Yeah. Yeah. Because Starbucks is like promoting it now. It's not just like they're throwing it on the menu and sort of the,
hiding,
you know,
it.
The vegan box, you know, and like, hey, by the way, if you want the vegan menu, just whisper a code and we'll give it to you or something. You know, this is where they're actually going to be putting it front and center, promoting it, making it cool. And again, this is all part of a whole different cultural dynamic and corporate strategy dynamic that is totally different because companies are seeing more and more pressure being placed on them by their investors to become more carbon friendly, purely for bottom line reasons, because companies that are more carbon and environmentally resilient going forward are likely going to perform better and have less risk. Very much so.
And are there any other products or companies that you're really excited about right now that are, you know, whether it's because the product's so great or they're up and coming?
Yeah. I mean, it's a long list. I would say, certainly for products that are in the market, I would say the Just Egg is an incredible
That's
product.
Awesome.
So what it is, it's an egg alternative. You can get it in a, you know, I think in Costco. I mean, it's been in Walmart. It's certainly been in Target. I'm not 100% sure where it is now, but you can get it in a lot of different places. If you live in New York, you can get it at Le Pain Quotidien, which is a very popular sort of fast casual restaurant. They've actually used their product to replace all of their egg frittatas, just to give you a sense of how, not just as an addition to the menu, it replaced their traditional egg with this product. And I've tried it a number of times, and it blows my mind every time. You can actually go on my column and see I've written about it a number of times, and it's just an incredible product. Only getting better. It's made from mung beans, if you can believe it. It's a 4,000-year-old bean from Asia, and it is really, really good. And so they're in food service now, so it's showing up in stadiums, universities, hospitals, and that's a company who has raised money, I think recently at a $1 billion valuation, that could very easily go public in the next couple of years if things go right. Calafia, to me, and Oatly are the two most exciting plant-based dairy milks, and can't recommend them enough. I love their product. I love their teams. I love their brands. I mean, they are just crushing it. On the plant-based seafood side, I would say check out Ocean Hugger. They make an interesting plant-based tuna, and I think their eel is in the market as well. The tuna, funny enough, is a tomato-based product, but very hard to know the difference, particularly if you're doing it in like a sushi wrap with other flavors in there. The eel is eggplant-based. And then there's also Good Catch, which is making both tuna and I think crab cakes. They are by far the most in the market plant-based seafood company that I've seen so far that actually tastes good. I'm pretty sure they're everywhere in Whole Foods and just built a big production facility in Ohio. So you should see a lot more of their product in different markets going forward. But still, plant-based seafood is in its infancy. It has a lot further to go.
Michael, thank you so much for this. This is not only incredibly informative, but it is really helpful.
Yeah, my pleasure.
If you would like to learn more about Michael and his work and the companies that we just talked about, go to our website. It's speciesunite.com. And while you're there, go ahead and subscribe to receive our newsletter, which is a weekly newsletter on what's happening to animals globally, as well as upcoming podcasts. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you have a spare minute, please do us a favor and rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps people find the show. And if you'd like to support the podcast, which we would greatly appreciate, we are also on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'd also like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful day.